So last week, we had a wonderful conversation where we wanted to explore the concept of value, and we wound up in a slightly different area. I'm the first to admit that. But one thing that I've been thinking about since then is related to value and value creation. And I think that it relates in this, that it relates to value and skill. And how I sort of think about that, and what I want to hear your opinions on, Kim, is, and your insights, is that we can say that proficiency and skill is something we can, to an extent, measure by how others see us. So we're skillful and competent in a social context where others say that what we're doing is done competently and skillfully, and that should enhance value, the value of the artifacts we create. So what is the real value of skill improvement, and how do we think about that, and how do we create an environment where skills grow? Big question. Give me a nice, simple answer, please.
Oh, that is a very big question. And my brain immediately goes to my knitting. I do like to knit. And I remember quite a while ago, I was complaining about how I'm so scared about dropping stitches. And Toby, you said you should do deliberate practice. And I'm like, oh, that's a good idea. But you know, I never really did it. Until recently, when I decided to try to learn how to do what's called Fair Isle knitting, or Shetland knitting. It's with two colours and you knit with two hands, the different colours, one in each hand. I thought it was going to be super tricky. I watched some YouTube videos and I thought, gee, that looks really hard, but I'll give it a go. And instead of going straight into a garment and knitting it, what I did instead was I got two scrap balls of yarn and I practiced. So I did deliberate practice for the first time, which was really, really good. And what that now means is I'm really confident. It was a lot easier than I thought it would be. Very confident now knitting with two different colours of yarn. But I hadn't really thought about making time to do deliberate practice. And I'd always reflected on it after what you said years ago about deliberate practice for knitting. So now I've done it and it's actually really good. And now my repertoire is so much expanded in the different types of knitting I can have a go at. So that's just one thought where my brain went straight away.
That seems so interesting. I'm not a big knitter. I've probably knitted approximately 4 square centimeters in my life, and that was under threat of bad grades. But conceptually, what I'm hearing here is that you actually had a bit of performance anxiety around sort of, if I'm dropping a stitch when I'm doing this big garment, that's going to be a big problem. And you actually carried that around literally then for years, partially sort of actually causing you undue stress to a certain extent. And then you go in and deliberately practice the thing in a safe environment. And all of a sudden you go, oh, that wasn't so hard.
Exactly.
That seems like something that's happening an awful lot within our industry.
Yeah. And the picking up stitches, I found this nifty little tool. It's a crochet hook on one end and a knitting needle on the other. They're quite short, probably 5 centimeters long. And it's deliberately designed for picking up stitches that have been dropped. And I can tell you, since I bought those, I have actually dropped one or two stitches. And it's so easy picking them up. It's really, really good. So having the right tool for the job. So there was deliberate practice for the two-color knitting, which I'd always been scared of. And scared of dropping stitches, now I've got the right tool. And it's super easy to pick them up. So I just didn't know that tool existed.
So that's how there's a tool for it. There's a methodology to actually fixing these problems, to recover swiftly. That actually makes it more safe to actually do the practice in itself. And this also seems very topical to me. I was thinking about this earlier this week, actually, where when we're discussing safety, we often end up framing it as this sort of, I'm not dropping stitches, sort of, in a sense, where I'm not falling. But this is a much more useful frame, that safety actually comes from knowing you can recover. It's not about never dropping a stitch, which is sort of a very tall order. That requires perfection. It's actually about sort of having the tools and the skills required to sort of, when that happens, you can safely recover and get back to a good place and just keep on rolling, essentially. It's not safety is not falling. Safety is being able to pick myself up or getting picked up in a good way.
So in a way, improvement can be a couple of things. Improvement can be focused on trying to get to perfect and doing things so well that you never, ever, ever make a mistake. Or improvement can be learning all of the different things you can do, as you say, to recover when stuff goes a bit odd or a bit weird.
And I think that, so when I think about improvement, I think that it's, I want to improve simply because it gives me more calmness. Sort of if I'm the better I am at the particular skills, the less I sort of postpone them, the less I dread them, the more I can explore other things, the more skillful I am at the constituent parts and sort of the different maneuvers involved in whatever I'm doing, the different moves, the more artfully I can express myself and the more freedom I have and the more relaxed I can be about the doing and the more I can think about the thing that really matters, the outcome in a certain sense. So the more skillful I'm at knitting, the more I can think about the garment and the easier I have to enter this flow state in a sense. So I think that's an interesting aspect too, that the value of getting better, even when my skills were sufficient, is that it gives me something, sort of, it's not only the improvement to the work product, it's also the improvement to how I relate to doing the work, in a sense. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and the other thing that I think is important is I was resisting doing deliberate practice with scrap yarn because I thought, well, I'm going to invest some time and I'm not going to make something that's useful at the end of it. So I think there's times when it is a good idea to do something that you would then break down again or throw away. But I think most of the time we do improvement through our normal day-to-day activities and through actually creating something. What are your thoughts on that, Toby?
Oh, so this is one of those topics where I have really strong opinions. And I think that this distinction is really important, that we need time and a place for deliberate practice, sort of going running through katas, stuff like that, sort of just doing the things, sort of knitting with different colors, sort of training. And that's important. But I think that's we tend to talk a lot about that. But to me, that's a really, really tiny bit of how we actually improve the craft of creating software. That's what I'll be talking about. I don't knit. I knit software, not socks. And I think that integrating deliberate reflection. So Donald Chan has a great book called The Reflective Practitioner. And that's a book about how I think it's architects, how they think and how they think in action. And I think that's hugely relevant to us because in our line of work, be that coaching or code crafting, we need to find ways to not only go through the motions, but to actually reflect on the motions as we're doing them. I think that's where the majority of the practice we get and the majority of the improvement we ought to be having comes from looking and being present in the doing. And I think that's what we need to explore, how to integrate better without sort of stopping production to learn. How do we learn while producing? And I think that that's a rich area to explore. And I think that's actually the main value of a lot of the practices that we tend to push, but we don't really know why they work, or sort of we have theories about why they work. And the theories, I think, are mostly wrong, or at least very badly phrased. So I'll take my favorite, TDD. Mm. A lot of people try to argue that TDD is a thing we should adopt because it reduces the defects and sort of creates a test suite and it validates that we've written not only the right thing, but that we've written the thing in the right way. And to a certain extent, I'm sure this happens. But I think that's a tiny benefit of the process of TDD. What TDD does, as many other processes, as A3 does, A3 sort of plays in this similar area, I think, is that it slows down your thinking and it slows down your doing enough that you become aware of what you're actually doing. And that actually puts you in a space, you're not just producing by rote, you're actually in a space where you can more consciously and deliberately evaluate, reflect, refine. And that is actually the best way to accelerate your own skills and your own learning. And I think partially this is why pair programming also works. If you're pair programming with someone that can, in a sense, give you objective feedback, that's a great way to learn. And if you use it as a teaching tool, it's also a great way to practice explaining what you're doing, which is one of the best ways to learn. So I think that's sort of, this is where I see, where should most of the improvement happen? It should happen within the work.
Yeah, another place that we can reflect is like going for a walk. I was going for a walk this morning in lovely Melbourne, where we all have to wear masks whenever we're outside at the moment, which is fun going uphill for me, but getting used to it. And I was thinking about constraints and using Jay Bloom's idealized design in order to identify current constraints and working on the constraints. And I was just thinking, oh, I think I could map those constraints on a Wardy map. So I was actually playing with it in my head as I walked along. And I will be using that for some of the work that I'm doing to help explain how constraints are related to each other. And I'm not 100% wedded to the idea yet. I'm not quite sure that it's going to work. But if I didn't go for that walk this morning, I don't think I would have come up with the idea of trying to map constraints on a Wardy map.
I think that's a super interesting idea. We'll need to talk more about that as it evolves. And I also think that what you're highlighting is an equally important part of the improvement process. And that's sort of the deliberate disconnection and sort of more free-flowing as reflection in a completely different context. You walk. I think that there's no secret to anyone that I run. And I usually have a midweek long lunch run. And I have often, over the years, I've been doing that for almost 10 years at this point. Probably more when I think of it. Anyway, I tend to talk about that as one of the most productive times in the week for me, because I'm deliberately out and sort of I'm free to sort of have my mind wander and find these sort of other connections. And I think that there's these two modalities in play here. This sort of it's the doing that is sort of the big bulk of what we actually do. We're actually performing most of the time. And then we have the deliberate reflection, and we need both of these two in order to sustainably improve. We have the playing the scales, and we have the performing the songs in a practice way, and we have performances. So we have these different modalities, and we need to be mindful about switching between them and ensure that we don't discount the learning potential in either one of them. But I do think they have very sort of, you probably spend more time discussing with clients and thinking about their problems and coaching than you do taking walks. Well, depending on the economy currently, that might be sort of debatable. But you have a ratio between these two that's probably leaned towards the active work.
Mm.
But we need the active work to make the reflective work valuable. That's how I think about it. Without the practice, the theorizing doesn't make much sense. Without practice, there can be no theory, and the theory without practice is equally worthless.
So I'm kind of seeing two modes for each of the two modes, so to speak. So the active work, where when we're actually creating something useful, there's the mode where we're doing it, and we're doing it potentially at a rapid pace or at a non-reflective pace. And that to me is like building up the muscles, is actually getting the work done. And then the reflective mode of getting the work done is, like you talked about, using a structure like TDD, using an A3 process, talking people through it or pair programming, those sorts of things. So that's sort of the active work, doing something useful. And then there's the reflective part of it. And the reflective part of it, there's the deliberate practice. So deliberate practice, can I do it? How do I do it? You know, in a safe way that's potentially throwaway. And then the other one is in a different context, going for a walk, going for a run, having some reflection time deliberately to make connections. So I'm kind of seeing that there's practice and reflective together in those, but one is on building something that is useful and the other is you're not actually creating something that you're going to use at the end of it.
Mm. So what I just thought when you said that is that I think this actually, it speaks very well to me, because you have what I would think that one of the axes is forced practice versus, I don't know what's on the other axis, something that sort of is the opposite of forced.
it's like word. a bycatch when you're fishing. There's probably a good word for it. We'll come up with it.
Yeah. So how I'm thinking about that is, to sort of clarify it, is that in both the main modalities here, we have a situation. Deliberate practice is by definition hard. If you look at Erickson's work around this, deliberate practice isn't particularly fun. You do it to work on getting better, and sort of it's very, very deliberate. It's very sort of there to sort of, it's probably guided by something outside of yourself. This is sort of how you improve. You need a coach, you need feedback, or you can find these things, but it's hard work. You can't do particularly much of it because it's draining. And so that's forced in a sense. You're sort of, you're really going for that thing that that makes you feel bad. And on the other end there, sort of on the non-forced bit, you're taking a walk, you're letting your mind sort of go over this at its own pace, and you hope for serendipity to strike. So you have sort of the forced deliberate practice and you have the free-flowing walk. And when you go to the, so that's in the reflective area of this. And when you go in the active doing area, you actually have the same thing where you have the sort of the mindful doing, the sort of I can do and reflect, and I have the sensing. That's actually the unforced. That's more like taking the walk. And this is where I think most of us, when we're thinking about thinking, this is where we spend most of the time. We're reflecting on what we're doing, but we're not pushing in any particular direction except on the reflection bit. But the forced version of this is actually the doing it as quickly as I can, doing it at the forcing it to the point where my skill breaks, to where my skills break down. And this is where most of us really struggle to, this is hard in the same way deliberate practice is hard, because this is where we're running as hard as we can. So we're constantly sort of falling over ourselves slightly. We're sort of, we're not producing work that's of the quality that we would like it to be. We're playing at the top of our ability, so it actually sounds a bit out of tune all the time. And this area is interesting because this is, of course, similar to working under hard stress, which you shouldn't be doing a whole lot of time. And what I think is interesting over that that quadrant is that I think that it's undervalued. We tend to sort of work at a pace where we can produce our good work, because that makes sense. We should be sort of reflectively producing good work. But working at that breaking point actually has huge value. One, it's indicative of your true skill. If you can work at pace, and if you can work sustainably at a higher pace, that actually means you have a better base conditioning. Exactly like a runner. I have a pace I can keep all day.
Yep.
And I have a pace that I can't keep for a very long time. And sort of, if you want to measure my fitness, the second one actually gives a really good indication of that. And when we have we can't do this with enough quality in the time allotted, that also is a way to gauge our skill gap in a sense. It's indicative of, okay, so what would have been required for us to produce this thing within that time? Probably fluency, skills, or something else. So it's sort of the forced bits gives us a lot of information about our shortcomings, and the unforced bits is a safe space to get slightly better and improve and find new connections and sort of, and then we need to go into the other modality to sort of, again, find the boundaries.
That was a nice walk through the different spaces. It was making me think about a time. I was trying to think of a time when I forced myself in a working capacity. I was packing biscuits in a factory night shift. And at the start of the shift, I had to assemble the boxes, which meant taking them from flat and folding the bottoms of them and putting tape over them. And I would challenge myself to do the number of boxes in a shorter and shorter time frame at the start of every shift. I always enjoyed that. Yeah, I don't know that that was a force though, but it was a little bit tricky because the way that you put the tape over the box, it was hard to get it neat unless you did it a particular way. It was very easy for it to crumble up and twist and things like that. So yeah, there was a little bit of skill involved in it, and it was quite nice to get faster and faster at it.
But that sounds exactly like sort of you forced it yourself by sort of going, okay, can I beat my own time? So you made it a competition against yourself, and you can see your skill improvement coming in that you're producing the same high quality work, but the time required for it goes down as the movements become more automatic or as you change the strategy of doing it. So I think that's a wonderful way to think about it, and also it highlights the need for repetition in a lot of these things. One thing I can sort of see, I can see how I can create repetition. Another main benefit of TDD in my mind is you write more code, so you get more repetitions, and the more repetitions you get in, the more fluid it becomes and the easier it becomes to sort of do more things, and it forces you to do more refactors, so you get better at refactoring, and that lowers the barrier. So I can see this, how this works in when I'm writing software, How does it work for you as a coach and consultant and facilitator? How do you get your reps in?
So I would say the easiest one to wrap my head around is designing and facilitating a workshop. So it took me a while to get into rhythm with this. And now that I'm a consultant, it's a lot easier. What I do is I work with the client, work out what is the purpose of the workshop. I create a facilitation plan. It's got a fairly reasonable level of detail about what's going in there, because that way both me and the client are confident about what's going to happen in that session, and then execute it, and that's all good. So I've gotten to a point where I'm very comfortable with that as a way of crafting what should we do. So how do I get better and better at that is I've created things that are to a point reusable, but it's not just a cut and paste. It is a here is the format, here are some things that are common, but each of them needs to be shaped, because most workshops that I do are not exactly the same. Yeah, so I would say that's one thing that it's easier to wrap my head around, that I've found ways to smooth the process and get better at it.
So there seems to be when you're saying that, there seems to be a very attractive little trap in this. And I'll start off with an anecdote from when I was recruiting many years ago, and we had this candidate that we were searching for developers, and he went very early on in the interview. He said something that has stuck with me since then. He's like, yeah, but I don't really want to be a developer. I want to be an architect. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, okay, why do you want to be an architect? And he's like, well, how many if statements do you actually need to write? And sort of it was like, I want to be an architect because then I don't need to write if statements. And I've written all my if statements, I should be able to just move on. And it seems to connect into this in a sense that me as a fairly untrained facilitator, I would, of course, go practicing creating facilitation plans and workshop designs. That's a lot of work. I'll just copy paste whatever Kim did. just give me the result, and I can use that, because I won't be doing very many of them, and of course it will heighten my level. If I base it on your template, it will be better than anything I do from scratch. But there seems to be a point where I need to do enough work with it to make it my own, in a sense. And how do I avoid just blindly following the template, blindly following the recipe, and still inject that practice and iteration that is actually building the skill into it? You see, there's a tension in here, the neatness of reuse and the efficiency of it, but also how that denies me the actual practice of going through the process and thus doing the wax on, wax off thing.
Yeah, you're right, because the facilitation plan makes sense to me, and it makes sense to the people that I'm explaining it to. But for some, it'd be like me picking up one of your conference presentations and trying to talk to it, and probably vice versa. You know, if we just picked it up cold and read out the slides, both you and I don't tend to put a lot of text on our slides, I think we'd come up with very different ways of presenting.
Yeah, PowerPoint karaoke is super funny, but it's not a particularly professional, compatible with a professional setting, I suppose. No, but I think that there's some interesting tensions in there, that obviously there's a need to practice a lot of things, and also quite obviously we're constrained, those constraints again, by the time available, but we're also constrained about the ideas available. That's obviously a thing, as you said, if we don't have the right idea, we can't actually do the things. We need to get the right ideas in order to improve too. And we need good objective feedback on how good actually looks. And we need to establish a sense of why is improvement actually even important? Why is it? Why would we want to improve?
Oh, you get bored if you don't keep improving. I mean, I've been knitting socks a lot, and it's only been since the start of this lovely pandemic thing that I've tried to do some other things, and ended up knitting a lot of hats and doing the two color knitting and all that kind of stuff. It's been a really good opportunity for me to expand, and I didn't realize how much I was missing out on by not trying different things and not trying to improve and expand my repertoire. That That's from the knitting perspective. From a work perspective, yeah, don't want to get bored there either. I get a lot of enjoyment personally from feeling that I am getting better at doing things and I am achieving more value and I'm adding to the repertoire of tools into my toolkit so that I've got more things to adapt to a broader range of situations. So that's how I see improvement. It gives me the opportunity to do more valuable things in many, many different contexts.
What I just started thinking when you said that is that if boredom, to an extent, is the signal that we're plateauing, or that sort of, that's interesting in itself, isn't it? That if we express boredom with the thing we're doing, then it actually gives us a lot of, I would say that if we use boredom as a signal for we're ready to improve, instead of just going, this is boring, if we go, so boredom is a signal, it gives us agency all of a sudden. And because how I heard what you were saying is that sort of, okay, so we have a pandemic running, you're doing more knitting than you used to, and all of a sudden it starts feeling not as fun anymore, sort of it starts getting bored, and you go, oh, well, wait, I can make a hat instead.
Yeah.
you're transmogrifying the skill and sort of go, okay, let me try to do something new with the same skill. And that forces you in a bit to improve. So the improvement then removes the boredom out of the activity. And it also gives you options and opportunity.
Yeah. And also the needs changed. Yeah. So that's an interesting thing too. I think there's where you can see there is a need and you're not quite sure how to meet it. So you learn how to meet it. So I think that there's those two triggers. One is the I'm feeling a little bit stale and I want to do something else. And there's a new need over there. How do I meet that need?
So that's sort of improvement to bridge between what I know I can do and a more desirable outcome in a sense. So we have sort of, we can use boredom in a sense as the signal that we need to inject something new, either we can add a constraint. We can try to do a new thing. We can do it using new tools, or we can do it by artificially constraining ourselves. Can I do it faster? Can I do it with more of some other quality attribute, for example? So we have these different, and then we have what you seem to be driving towards now is we can also use, I guess, in motivational theory, and if we'll go into flow and Csikszentmihalyi, we could say we can also use arousal, the sort of the want to do something new, as the signal that there's the arousal of wanting to do something new, and the anxiety of not knowing how to do it also pairs up to sort of going, here's an opportunity for improvement, and the improvement would be valuable in that it would enable this new thing.